This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
This episode of Best of the Rest is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks with over 200,000 titles in their selection. You can go out to audible.com/nerdylegion, sign up for a trial membership, and get a free audiobook. That's audible.com. So here we are, Best of the Rest, our post C2E2 episode.
Back from Miss E2 C2 3PO.
Yes.
Okay, that whole thing was my fault, and I guess that's an insider joke for everyone that we would call it anything but E2 C2.
No, wait,
C2 E2. And you see, that was my problem at first, is like I couldn't remember, was it the C's first or the E's first? And so then I just got to calling it anything, and I guess it took on its mind of its own, and off it went.
Right, right.
But it's C2 E2.
Yes. Not 3CPO or whatever, all the other stuff that the guys did. And they did it mostly because I knew it irritated me, so...
Well, that's why you just got to learn that trick of not showing your irritation to people, and then they'll just leave you alone.
That's true. That is true.
Like beans and chili.
I'm not even going to start on that. That's going to let that go.
Or black mass shipping on time.
I'm going to let that go, too. By the way, Black Mask did have a book. Did have a booth at C2E2, but they didn't show up till today. All right. There's boom. Bad joke. Bam, bam.
Well, you gotta have a Nerdy Legion podcast now. We even heard a dad joke in a Batman panel.
Oh well, yeah. Dad jokes are pretty popular. Dad jokes are pretty popular.
So anyway, you recovered from the show, from the con?
Yeah, I think it's Thursday as we record this, so it's been 4 days. So yeah, I'm starting out.
Did you get any of the con crud?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a combination of things. Fatigue and not used to doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of being on your feet and walking around and fending yourself through the crowd and all that. So
right.
My main thing is I don't think I've walked that much on concrete in a while, so my hips were like starting to hurt and my feet.
Yes.
So. But it was a fun experience. It was a fun experience.
Yes, it was the first C2E2 for both you and me.
Mm-hmm. And the first like major con. I'd been to a few Wizard Worlds, but I don't think they kind of compare to this, so.
It's the biggest con I've been to. I've been to the Dallas Fan Expo once. Cause I've never been much on cons. I've never really wanted to go. And certainly didn't enjoy any as much as I did this. And I know that most of my enjoyment is being with a group of people. With the other guys, you know, so you can kind of share experiences, talk about things. That makes it much more enjoyable than going by yourself.
Yeah, I can agree with that, because when you need to take a break from something, you can just go hang out with somebody or just talk to them or whatever and just take a break as opposed to being there by yourself.
Right.
So, fun stuff. So, what do you like most about it?
Gosh.
Did I put you on the spot?
No, it's hard because I liked a lot of things. I liked being able to, you know, have access to different artists. Put, you know, faces, real faces, although you can see pictures, but to really see an artist or a writer that you've admired, you know, being right there with them and talking with them and see that they're, for the most part, just basic people. You know, you have a few that get a little bit conceited about their work, but for the most part, you know, they're really nice people that they understand that the fans are what drives their work, and that, you know, the nicer they are to the fans, the more they're going to get, you know, recognition and sell more books.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I kind of liked also, is just, you know, there they are sitting at their booth or whatever. Hey, there's Chris Claremont sitting behind his booth talking on the phone. Hey, there's Matt Kent. Hey, there's Terry Moore. Hey, there's, and they're just all there sitting behind a table with a skirt on it, and they got some books out there, and you can just walk up to them or get in line and chat with them for a bit, get something signed, pick up some stuff, and move on. And, you know, you can, they all had access where you didn't need cash. You could pay for it with a card or a credit card if you wanted to. And it was, you know, it's like you said, nice to, like, meet them in the flesh and all that and talk to them and all that. And so, and they're all just kind of all compact there together. So on this long little strip, so you can just go from one short aisle to the next aisle, and there's somebody you can recognize on each row.
Right. I still can't get over when we walked by Chris Claremont's booth and there was nobody at it. He's just sitting there behind it talking on the cell phone. No.
Well, maybe he ran everybody off so he could take the call.
Well, maybe. It's possible. It really stunned me. Don't you people know who this is and what he's done for comics?
Yes. Yes. And I guess it's all about the what have you done for me lately.
And we didn't stop because we were on a search for Sean Murphy, which we never found at the table.
That is true. We never did find him, did we? Even though it said he was at, what, U17? And where's U17? Well, here's row U. Where's 17? So.
Yeah.
But I did see him at the Batman panel.
Yes, I know you did.
So he was not, I don't think I've ever seen any pictures from him, and he seemed a lot younger than I thought.
He is not, man, I don't know, he's not terribly young, but yeah, he is, gosh, I wouldn't even be hazard to guess, but he's a younger.
How long has he been putting out art? How long has he been into biz?
Boy, now you have put me on the spot, because I could.
Well, there you go. Well, you got to use the, DuckDuckGo.
Yep, DuckDuckGo.
When did Punk Rock Jesus come out?
That's been a few years.
Well, a few years to some people is like 20.
All right. Well, I don't have it to hand, so I can't look at it, and I don't remember. All right. Sean Murphy, artist, Wikipedia. Let me see. It looks like he's been working 2000.
Ah, there you go. So,
Punk Rock Jesus came out in, well, it was serialized, so it was from July of 2012 to January of 2013.
That's more recent than I thought.
The oldest comic they have him working on is Crush with Jason Hall. From Dark Horse, and that was 2003. So he's been working, you know, 15 years.
Well, he's been working that we know professionally for 15 years.
15 years, well.
He could have been doing some stuff before that, just not didn't nothing notable.
Correct. Unless we were talking about the age, how old Sean Murphy was. He's 37.
37. Well, not that has any any inkling on, like, C2E2 or not, but.
No, I just, somebody, you know, he went. Another note, interesting side note, bit of trivia. He went to, he went to a couple of different colleges, but he did most of his work at the Savannah College of Art and Design.
I've been by there.
And it's notable because it was one of the very first colleges that actually offered a degree program in what they call, well, they call it sequential art, but it was a degree program basically for comic book writers. So.
Huh. Writers or artists?
Artists, really.
Okay.
They may have been writing. I don't know. But
classes you can take on that over a course of... it could be a two-year program or a four-year program. I don't know.
I don't know. But anyway, neat side note. Okay, so let's flip the question. What did you like least about C2E2?
Well, you know what? I am not going to talk about the crowds because that is totally independent of C2E2. If they're doing the show right, they should have the crowds.
Yeah.
So, if I had to like something the least, going through the booth, I could not find on Friday or Saturday any deals on any back issues, really. Especially some of the stuff I was looking for up on the walls or out on the displays. It seems like all the comic book shops had brought their best wares, and they really loved them because they priced them such that they wouldn't sell, or I wasn't going to buy them.
Yeah, I see that. It definitely was that way because we went through a lot of things Friday, and I didn't buy anything Friday. I was going to make mental notes on where they were located, and all right, I'll come back tomorrow and look at them and buy them. But I got back Saturday, and I was like, you know, I'm really not. I can get these things probably at a much better price somewhere else.
Well, you know, and then I was listening, and then I got to investigate, and then I found a two or three schools of thought. So there's some items in every booth that they have no intention to sell, and it's priced that way. It's supposed to be eye candy. You're supposed to stop and go, ooh, look at that. And you stop and you see that, then you start looking. So that's just, I think that's basic con 101 for these shops. You got to put it some eye candy. Two is, you know, you're going to have people that go to cons and they see that they're not really, I don't want to say savvy, but they just don't buy stuff that much, but they have a few things. And if they see it there and it's convenient for them, they'll pay the price because it's the convenience for them. They don't want to do the hunt or anything like that. And, you know, I do that on certain things. Certain things I buy and I could go find it cheaper, but you know what? I don't want to mess with it. And I'm not a haggling person. And, you know, that's the third point. Some of it, well, part A of the third point is, you know, some of you just got to haggle. You got to get up there and you got to offer something and they counter and you offer and counter. And that's not my personality. Plus, I think the big thing is you wait the Sunday afternoon or towards the close. They don't want to take it back with them, and that's when you can work out deals. So,
I don't understand that, because it's like, okay, if you don't want to take this back, then why don't you offer competitive or reasonable prices the whole damn weekend and sell it over the whole weekend?
Well, because you have that off chance that somebody's going to come in and that's the book they're looking for, and as for the convenience, they'll pay at an elevated price. I'll tell you what I was looking for. I was looking for a Conan number one from Marvel. I think it's 72, 73. I saw several of them, but I don't think there was a one that was under $400 or $500. And those were mid-grade ones. And I can buy, you know, and a mid-grade being anywhere from 4 to 6 or 2 to 7. You know, I can go on eBay all day long and find an 8 or an 8.5 graded for $300 or $400. I mean, that's how bad I was seeing it on there. So,
wow, yeah.
And then you had some that weren't even slabs, so you were going to have to go over it, and you know they were $400, $500 or so. So, I mean, you saw those Batman 181s,
yes.
And they were wanting how much for them? And the centerfold was missing, the spine was rolled, and you can find much better on eBay.
Yeah, the cheapest one I saw, and it was a wall book, back up on the wall, you know, so, and it was $350.
No, we looked at one that was $80.
I don't remember that one.
But it didn't have the centerfold.
Oh, okay.
And the lower right corner was beat and creased, and that cover's tough, because it's got that, 3/4 of it's got kind of that pinkish red background.
Yeah.
And it just shows any perfection and highlights any perfection. So.
But I also saw some that were going for over $500.
Oh, yeah.
And still, the one I saw, it was $500, and it still had the spine looked in bad shape. Not only rolled, it was almost like it was rolled. All the color was broken on it. I'm like, man. Maybe something, you know,
that's from the era when kids would roll it up and stick it in their back pocket.
Right. And I'm like you in the fact that I'm not a haggler. It's like, it's just a stupid game. If you're willing to sell it for that price, then I don't know. It bores me to have to do that.
It does me too. But then I've met people, they just love doing that. They can sit there and go to the car dealership and they can haggle for 3 or 4 hours and they're all happy with them. I'm just like, you know, show me what you're selling it for. I'll tell you what I get. You know, if I don't like what you're selling it for, I may offer. Here's what I'd pay. And we meet somewhere in the middle. And that's when I'm in a good mood.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was hoping to go up there and find some stuff I've been looking for. So now I think I'm just going to have to settle and find some deals on eBay or some other items. Now, I actually do have a Batman 181. And based on the prices I've seen, I got a sweet deal for it.
It's good. Is it slab?
No, it's not slabbed. I'm debating on having it slabbed. No, I bought it raw, but it was too good of a price at the time, and if those values are anything, any indicative, then yeah, I got it for a deal. But that's the thing. I know I can, and maybe that's my curse. I know I run into stuff out there, and you just got to keep your eyes open, and you can find stuff.
Right.
I got it on an online auction. And yeah. I'm trying to remember if it was a live auction or a Facebook auction. But I got on there, and here's the thing. The guy had advertised he was going to put it up for auction that night. And everybody was all excited about it. So I'll go in and see what it goes for. And by the time it came up, there were six people watching.
Wow.
And it came up. Somebody bid something. I bid something. They outbid me. And I say, okay, you want to play? I jumped it up a couple of $100 and nobody else wanted to play. I got it. And about 5 minutes after I got it, some other people jumped in and they saw the trail and they started offering over my thing, but it was too late by then.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was an auction for a book, you know, not eBay or anything, but there's only six people looking. And if it was like the five other people were on there just to, see what it went for, and they weren't going to bid, you can get it at a ridiculous price. And I think that's what I did.
Yeah, I was looking for the thing, but I forgot the damn list to bring my list with me of what I need.
Yeah, you know, that's why I keep debating when I'm going to cons about having something on my phone or whatever, but I'm an old school and I like to pull the list out of my wallet.
I'm the same way. I want paper. I don't know.
Well, you can see it, and then when you find it, you cross it out.
Right.
And you don't have to have cell phone signal. You don't have to have a low battery. It's so tiny you can't see it on the screen.
Yep. I agree. And it's just something about it. I don't know. Your life is old school. But I need to get a new one of those typed up and start taking it with me.
Well, my thing is I think I got three or four lists in my wallet, and I need to take, and I've crossed things off on all of them, and I need to consolidate.
Yep.
And I mean, most of my stuff now is actually tending more towards the indie stuff from there. I saw a Caliper Press that was the first appearance of the Crow. No, it wasn't the first appearance of the Crow. But I saw that on the wall, but oh, they wanted so much money for it. And, we went by a booth and they had most of the Valiant Nintendo books that they put out prior to the launch of their superhero universe. But the guy wanted so much for that set and everything. So, but there was a lot of old indie stuff up there. I was hoping to find some Cry for Dawn and I didn't see any of that, but there was a lot of Golden Age there and Silver Age, just gems.
Yes, there were.
And yeah. You know, and that's what I really like about shows like this, is you can go and see where they pull out the big boy books. And we went in one booth, and I think the cheapest book in that booth was $2,000. And that's the one that had the Tech 27.
Yes, and you saw that, and I never managed to make my way over there to see it.
Yeah. They had a Tech 27 and a Batman. What's the one with the Gothas Mansion? The Swipe? I think that's 121 is the Swipe.
Yeah, I think so.
But it's like Tech 35 or 37. And then they had some Showcase 14s, and I think he had seven Amazing Fantasy 15s. And he said at WonderCon he had eight. Somebody bought one, so he only had seven left. And that was just wow. And I think he only had like 40 books there, but they were all Marvel, DC, Golden Age keys, and maybe some early Silver Age keys.
Right.
And I don't think he left that booth all day.
No. I saw some, like from the 50s and 60s, some gold key books. Like I had, but they were in really bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, thinking about indie comics here, I was impressed by the number of booths I saw for indie comics. There was a good representation of the indie publishers there.
Yeah, I thought it was. How did you feel about people trying to promote their books?
And what
I got intercepted and pulled in by a guy that was telling me all about his book and showing it to me and everything, and then was wanting me to spend $5 to buy it.
that happened to me twice. I'm not sure. I mean, I understand needing to or wanting to promote your book, but I'm not sure that
that's the way to do it.
That bulldogging somebody as they're walking across the floor is, the best way to do it. Because people just don't tend to react that way. If you're going somewhere else, and that's both of the times it happened to me, I was either on my way to a panel or I was on my way to meet one of you guys. So it's like, I don't have time. I don't have time. Maybe I'll come back later. But, I just don't think that's an effective way to do it.
I like the organic way it happens. Like Nick was describing his experience with Martin, and he was like walking through Artist Alley, and he happened to notice some artist, and he liked his stuff, and he walked up and chatted to him and liked his stuff and everything like that. And after a couple of minutes of conversation, he bought some stuff and got a sketch and did, it was all, you try to grab the attention, not the individual.
Right.
And draw them in. Cause you can sit there and tell me all about your book, but you're just sitting there showing me stuff and flipping through it and all that. And I got to read a synopsis and I don't know. That's just not a way. And that was one of the things I didn't like, but it only happened to me really once. So I can't say it was a major thing at the show for me.
Well, I got stopped twice by people wanting money for nothing, for something else. It wasn't even comic books. One guy was wanting to, so we're trying to get kids off the street and out of drugs. We're putting together this basketball league and we, if you could give us $25, that would really help. If that's what you're really doing, I appreciate that, but no. I'm not giving $25 based on that, because I don't know if you're legit or if you're just...
Yes, you need more information behind you. You need a legitimate way. That's the stuff where you want to give online or it's at an event or something where it's just legit.
Yeah. It's like, how do I know you're not going to take that $25 and go buy... a bunch of alcohol for yourself. And the other guy that stopped me, he had books. He had actual books he was trying to give me. They were Eastern mysticism, spirituality. It was the Bhagavad Gita, then books on meditation and stuff. He was more clever about it. He's kind of what brought me by. He opened up with, "Oh, I love your hat. Where did you get that hat?" And I'm like, talking about that, giving him that information, and then he launches into his spiel. So he was clever about stopping people. He didn't just grab you and start talking.
Well, no, he forms a connection and gets you to talking about yourself, and then you kind of warm up, and then you get into your pitch.
Right.
So, but I don't know, and I guess my other thing about is some of them were so huge and had so many books, but they weren't in any kind of order. And it's like, I really want to go through those 20 long boxes, but it's going to take me an hour or more. And then if they have them stuffed so tight where you can't really flip through them.
I don't like that either. It's like, that's not the way I do my boxes, so I don't like
it. I know. And I know. And I found some Batman 457s, and I went into one booth, and they had it for $45. And then I went to two booths down, and they had it for $5.
Okay, how many of those do you have now?
I don't know, about 14.
Gosh. Okay.
And yeah, there's six different versions, so six of those 14 are unique.
Well, I get that, but I know you're continuing to buy what I think is the most common one, is the first print Indicia error.
No. I don't get them if they have the error now.
Okay.
I have them open up and see if it's the error or not. And then when they realize there's an error and they open it up, it's the error. And I'm like, already got it.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that is the most common one out there. I think because every time I see one, 8 times out of 10, it's the first print Indicia error.
Mm-hmm.
But people act like that's a rare one. Oh, it's got the error. Yeah, well, okay, got it. You can get it for, you can get that
five
one.
Bucks.
$5 or even less, probably. So, it's like, show me something, because I've got the first print Indicia error. I've got the second print Indicia error. No, second print with the error corrected.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all I've got, right?
Second print newsstand?
I don't have the second print. Second print newsstand is the rare one.
Yep.
The expensive one. Which, you sent me that email link for that one.
Yeah, I meant to see what that eventually went for.
I don't, yeah, I looked at it. He was not in good shape.
Yeah, but there's only like 15 known ones.
That's true. But I think it was already pretty high.
It was $200 when I, but there was still
okay,
like
was, four, yeah, there was still like 4 days to go, so it was like. All right, let's see if it's still.
But yeah, that was my big thing. It's like I'm gonna go through all these booths and I'm gonna find a Batman 457 and I'm gonna find a rare one. Of course, I was listening to another podcast, and the weekend before was IndyCon or the con in Indianapolis, and apparently somebody there found a Bloodshot Platinum for $5 and was offered $1,000 on the spot and didn't take it.
Okay. Oh, it's still here. The Batman 457 second. It's got 1 day and 23 hours, so it ends Saturday at 7:06 for me. There's three bids on it right now. It's at $263.
See?
Dang. Damn it. Damn it.
But I looked at the pictures, and the spine's got a lot of ticks up and down it.
Yeah, it's in rough shape.
It's in a 5 to 7 range. And it's getting close to what it's would be on the market until somebody finds a box full and releases 200 on the market.
Right.
In near mint shape. Which is always a possibility.
Oh yeah.
So.
Well, it's like the Superman number one that sold 3 or 4 years ago for $3 million. Was a 9.0. How does a comic from 1938? How is it a 9.0? I can't understand that.
Was it restored?
No, it was. There was one of the few that wasn't restored. It had white pages. Had white pages. I mean, it's like, oh, did you store this in a? Did you time travel this thing? Because. You know, those are printed on the cheapest newsprint they could find at the time.
And you know, the other thing I remember hearing is also on the inside cover, there was apparently a contest where you either drew or you colored something.
Right.
And you could win one of this is of $25.
Yeah.
And all you had to draw on it or whatever, cut it out and mail it in. So there were a lot of issues where that happened also.
And I think I misspoke. I think I called it Superman number one. It's Action Comics number one.
Okay, Action. Yeah, it's Action.
That's an expensive one. But I was like, I still can't get over that. A 9.0 comic book from 1938.
You know the Action Comics number one in early 70s was selling for $500?
That didn't surprise me. Because it was really in the 70s, mid to late 70s when the collecting really started to get take off.
Exactly.
A lot of the people who read comics as kids were getting to the point where they weren't trying to go back and fill in collections that they'd had, and so that's when that really...
Well, that's also when you started getting comic shops as opposed to moving away from newsstands.
Right, exactly.
And you started having back issues and you actually had to do it. But yeah, I remember I found in my LCS they had an old Overstreet from 1976 or 1975, and you know, when that happens, I go in and I start looking at the key books like that. Yeah, I think Action was about $500 then. Well, who knew? What's $500 now that in 30 years is going to be
that's true.
$3 million? We don't know. You think it's baseball cards? Nope. Football cards? Nope. Bitcoin? Maybe.
Oh, yeah, it could be. I just can't, because of the volume of comic books they print and the way that people save and collect now, I can't. It'd be hard for me to feature
that you're not thinking about.
Right. It's just hard for me to feature a comic book printed today that in 30 years, 40 years will be.
Well, it can't be a comic book because it's got to be something nobody's collecting. That's how the comic books did. Because if people had been collecting then, you'd have all kinds of actions. No. But they didn't. You know, it was just a commodity. It was like a newspaper.
True. Well, yeah, and they passed them around. I remember reading somewhere about that during that early golden age, 38, 39, you know, they were like, they printed 15 million copies of Action Comics.
And that's the thing. They printed probably about how many million of Action Comics number one?
That number I think was a little over 500,000.
Oh, was it? Okay. Yeah. But still 500,000, you know, there's not many comics that get over 100,000 today. Now in the early '90s, you could get up to.
Yeah, it was after it blew up and became wildly popular that they started printing more and more, and they got up to like 15 million a month. of course, this was the indirect market. It was going to newsstands, so some of those may have been returned because comic books were returnable in those days.
Yeah, and they got pulped for paper in the war effort once right. that started.
Yeah, or they just got lost or beat up. And
yeah.
But I remember reading during that time that comic book would change hands about 6 times on the average. So mm-hmm. some kid would read it. He'd, you know, trade it maybe to a friend for something he hadn't read. He'd pass it on to somebody else to read. Oh, you need to read this. And, you know, 5 or 6 people would read it. And a lot of times things just disappeared or they fell apart from so much use. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I guess to get back to the con, what did you find most surprising about C2E2?
It wasn't anything I was absolutely stunned that I saw.
I didn't think the cosplaying was as bad as I've heard from cons, where they just stop and it blocks everything. Anytime that was happening, I thought there was enough room to get around and everything, so I never got really irritated at that.
No.
Like I thought I was going to.
I didn't either, but I got to tell you, I was disappointed in the cosplay. I saw maybe a dozen cosplays that I thought were really well done. You know?
I think you set your expectations too high.
I did. I'm sure I did.
And there was a corner section for the cosplay, and for the ones that were probably done real well for the competition, they were probably over in the cosplay area because I think they were doing contests throughout the day or something like that.
Right.
Because there were so over there, and it would be packed. And I could look over and I could see, and there were some impressive cosplay going on.
Okay. I just didn't. You're right. I probably had too high expectations.
Well, I think you have to divide cosplay into 2 categories. You got the professionals, and professionals, I mean the people that are going all out on their cosplay because they want it to look realistic. They're going to compete. They want to show off their skills. They really like the character and all that. And then you have the people that just like, I'm going to a comic book convention, I'm just going to throw a couple of things together from the Goodwill store and just geek out and have fun and kind of dress like who I like.
Right. Well, I think part of the reason I was kind of focused on the cosplay was that was the one instruction I had from my wife on going to this. My wife doesn't care a hoot about comic books, but mm-hmm. she likes to see people doing unusual things. And that was my one instruction from her, was to get her some pictures of cosplayers.
Well, my whole problem was I kept seeing cosplay, but I thought it would be inappropriate to take a picture.
Well, yeah, that was part of it. Because, you know, they had that big, it's gotten real, you know, they had a poster up near the entrance, you know, and the title of it was Cosplay is Not Consent.
Yes.
And it was talking about, you know, touching people, which I wouldn't do anyway. I'm like, I'm not going to walk up to anybody, put my arm around them. But, you know, below that was a lot of other things. Like, you know, don't take pictures of anybody unless you ask permission first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're really trying to be respectful now of the cosplayers.
And one of the things in cosplay, I think, is like if, you know, you're the character or you're dressed up like that and you want to take the picture, but you have your pose. So you want to be asked to take the picture so you can do your action pose.
Right.
Because I remember going through once, there was like a Cable and a Domino, and they were just kind of sitting there chatting, and a couple of people started taking pictures, and once they noticed that, it's like, oh, hold on, and then they didn't mind the pictures taken, but then they got into their pose.
Right.
So, yeah. So, maybe next year. So, okay. So you didn't have any other... So that was that your big surprise or disappointment about?
I wouldn't. That was kind of a disappointment. I wouldn't call it a surprise. You know, I can't think of anything. I'm just like, whoa! I wasn't expecting this.
Beer.
The price of
beer.
I really wasn't
expecting beer on the con floor, but yes, there was.
Oh yeah.
At least that you could wander the floor with beer. Not that there was anything wrong with that and all that, but I just, you know, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was true. I don't think I thought about it one way or the other. You know, I can't think of anything I was absolutely just surprised about.
Would there be anything that you would change drastically, 180 degrees?
I mean, about the way they they presented the convention?
Well, anything, like panels or the layout or just the one thing I was thinking. So, you know, we were there representing Nerdy Legion in our podcast, and we would get stuff that it would do about interviews, but it would seem like, what was it, six weeks before the show, we would get company requests for, you know, if we want to do interviews and things. And you'd kind of like to get that all at once so you can do a better schedule, as opposed to you've got something, you schedule it, then you, a week later you get an email from another company or something for interviews, but it already conflicts with what you've scheduled.
Right. Now, that was something I was disappointed in, because we got several emails. I got one from Oni Press, I got one from Image, and I got one from DC. Specifically, you know, I know they were computer generated and using a list of names, but I got this email. These emails, and Ronnie got them too, you got them, saying the following creators are available for a short Q&A, or short interview. Email us back with who you'd like to talk to, and we'll try to work it out. And I did. I did a couple different ones for Image. I did one for Oni, and then I did requested Mags Visaggio for DC. And of all that, I heard back one. You know, the Image people never got back to me. Oni people never got back to me. Dark Horse people never got back to me. So it's like, if at least, you know, if you're going to send these out, at least follow up on them.
Yay or nay. But you know what the problem, you know what the problem is? You know what it is? We don't have any iTunes reviews. So you need, some people need to go out there and give us iTunes reviews so we can get some freaking interviews for you.
Well, the thing about it is, we were talking about this in Discord chat, the group today, and Martin pointed out, and I think, and he's right, that 15 iTunes reviews, 20 are not going to do much for you. You really ought to got started getting in the hundreds before you, and like,
nah, in reality, reviews don't do anything for you. It's downloads.
Yeah. We've got to get more downloads. Well, we've got to get more regular about putting out.
I'll start working on that. I'll start working on that download, that bot tonight.
Okay. Ed, I think Martin's clever enough to.
I'll try to stay one step ahead of Martin.
Okay. Well, that's good.
He's working too much. He can't keep up.
But, you know, maybe that's it. I don't know. They just got, but still, it irked me. Don't send this to me if you're not going to be serious about it.
I mean, that was one of the things we went there to do, was to try to do some. You know, we had chats with the artists and the creators, but it was probably not the appropriate environment to be recording.
Yeah, you can't go up to an artist's table and just pull out a recorder and start without having some. You know, you need to set this up ahead of time, really.
Yes.
But my one interview was I had with Mags Visaggio. About 8 minutes long. It's got some good information. And I'm going to append that to the end of our discussion. So after we finish up, then at the end of this episode, we'll have the interview.
But yeah, that was through the DC, her DC book. And they had an area set off. She had a handler come, talk to you, set everything up, lay out the ground rules, put you in a secure area. You had your time, was going to give you the warning when you were get about out of time and everything. So, you know, I thought that was all well handled. You know,
it was.
We just managed to get the one interview.
It was. Now, Ronnie requested several DC interviews, but and a couple from Image, but he went for the big, big guns. You know, he requested a Q&A with Tom King. I think he also requested an interview with Jason Aaron and Jason, well, both of them. For Southern Bastards.
Well, you know what? If you're going to swing, you need to swing for a home run.
Well, that's true.
Like he did Christopher Priest.
I think so, too. Yeah, he did Priest. I can't remember all he did, but he went for five or six big names.
Then why not? They offered them.
Yeah.
They threw their names out there saying they're willing to talk. So, yeah, it would have been nice to have got the confirmation of yes or no, just to have the confirmation.
But I also learned, because, you know, we were hoping to go up there and get several interviews. And the con is just not the place for interviews. Unless you have them set up ahead of time in a place, specific place where you can sit down. And even then, though, everybody is distracted. Like, I've tried to edit this interview to where it sounds better. But the sound quality is not, it's okay. But then there's another interview going on about 6 feet away from me. So this is, you're hearing part of this, you're hearing the other stuff interview kind of in the background of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not the ideal place to do. You can't do anything really in depth there. It's like these little 10-minute quick Q&As, but that's fine. That's what I would have wanted. Hopefully maybe next year more cred and be able to get some of these interviews.
Oh, so there is going to be a next year for you.
You know, I'm assuming there should be, yeah. I'm hoping to be.
No, no, we were a little tired after that Saturday afternoon.
Oh, I was beaten down Saturday afternoon. And you know, because I was so beaten down that I almost passed up the thing. The number one thing I wanted, commission, was Jock's signature on my Batman, on my Detective Comics 880. You know, and I had that all, I was, and he had two signings. One was scheduled at, from on Saturday, 11 a.m. to 12:30. Well, that was during when I was doing my interview, so I couldn't make it over then. And then he had a 4 to 5:30. And I was, by 3 o'clock, 3:30, I was toast. I'm like, I'm ready to go.
No, you were just upset because the first person in line had 80 books for him to
sign. That, yeah, I was. That's asinine.
That'd be, now, and that would be one thing you would change.
Yes, that would be. If you're going to have a, specifically, if you're going to have a scheduled signing that's only an hour to hour and a half, you limit the number of things a person can sign.
Or you start doing a progressive charge as the number of items increase.
Yeah. First five, okay, I'll sign five free. After that, it's from 6 to 10, it's X.
I still don't know if that would discourage some of them because all they're doing is taking it and throwing it on eBay or putting it on their shop wall.
That's true. Really then would be the hard limit. It's like, no, you get five signatures or at most, and that's it, or 10. But yeah, that, when you saw him, that guy, he bagged at least because he had all of them signed. Then he stepped off to the side when he got finished, and he's bagging all these books up, and he bagged at least 30 or 40 books up.
Well, at least he stepped to the side.
Well, that's true. But, and he was the only one that was that bad. The line moved pretty fast after that. But
yeah, but they could have been a little bit more better signage on where he was. I think I spent 20-25 minutes trying to figure out where that autograph session was going to occur.
Oh yeah, well I walked all the way up and down the autograph section. Walked down and walked back and didn't see his booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it about the time you got there. So, but anyway, I got it. Got it.
Oh, and I did see that you went to one of the sci-fi panels. So how was that live panel with I think it was the Legends of Tomorrow's stars?
They were one of the things I saw. Yeah, it was pretty interesting. They're pretty funny.
You know, I usually think these actors go to this and they're just in the back of their head, oh, I gotta go do this publicity thing with all these like geeks and all that. I'd rather be somewhere else and blah, blah, blah. Is that kind of how they were? Or
no.
Were they genuinely interested in interacting with people and doing all that?
They
or interacting with the crowd, you know?
Well, the Legends of Tomorrow cast, they were pretty funny, but they were doing a lot of, poking fun at each other of their characters and in the show. So they were doing a lot of humor.
Oh yeah, they work together all, you know, and when you're filming something, you know, it's for what, 20 hours a day for however many months or whatever. So
right.
they get a lot of time to interact with each other.
Yeah. And I specifically went over there because they were going to have a 15-minute, and they did these in 15-minute increments. Talk to somebody mm-hmm. and then next 15 minutes. They had Jerry Duggan, who's writing, his newest book is Analog for Image.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the ones I requested an interview with and didn't get. So I wanted to go see what he had to say. So that was my main reason for heading over to the sci-fi wire stage or whatever they called it.
Yeah.
Plus it was just nice. They had chairs over there. I could sit down. Some of the pressure.
You could do that in the panels too. So yeah, I went to the Valiant panel on Friday, and you were there too when they were doing the whole Valiant in general panel, which was, you know, that's kind of one of my first panels like that, and that was enjoyable. And, you know, the thing they do is they give you the secret password, and you can go to the booth and get one of the exclusive gold books, which was kind of fun. So that was nice. And then I went to, like, a Batman panel the next day. You know, they had Tom King and Joel up there, and Sean Murphy and J.G. Jones, I think, and two or three others. And that, you know, that was a fun panel, you know, talking about some of the stuff, and you got to see some stuff coming out, and a couple of images that were pretty shocking for me, which are now out previews-wise. So the one where it's like some pages showing what Booster Gold's going to do for Superman.
Right.
For Batman's wedding and some things like that. And you kind of see this image of what happens to Green Lantern. You're just like, what? So, that was interesting. And then, you know, it's just fun of them up there talking and interacting with each other. And they just seem like normal, regular people, which they are. They just have a high profile job.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the things you talk about with going to cons. I think people tend to think that these writers and artists are somehow, you know, on a different intellectual plane than they are, that, you know, there's something special about these people. And there is, they have talent, I'm not taking away, but personality-wise, social interaction-wise, most of them are just folks. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody was going on about how accessible and friendly Matt Kent is. And he is.
Matt Kent is so great.
He goes 110% at these cons.
Well, you know, we were in line for him, and it's just like, he just doesn't sign a book. He draws a little sketch and signs everything.
Right.
And so so it was pleasant in the way his booth was set up, or his table, is you wrapped around behind and then in front. So as you were coming up, you could see all the stuff he was doing. So you were entertained watching him do all this. And then you kind of knew what you could ask him to do and all that. I didn't get anything like that. He had a limited mind management,
right,
mixed media. And he was only putting out 6 a day. So the whole thing's limited to 500. He sold so many of them online. And then he was saving some to give away at cons. And at C2E2, it was there for 3 days. He was selling 6 a day.
Right.
And so Dewan and I were in line, and so right when we got up there, he had to leave to go to a panel. So his wife's there, and she's like apologizing and everything. So I said, no, that's fine. I just came up here to, you know, I can come back later or whatever, but I just came mostly to get the colorblind for my image. Oh, yeah, here it is. So I picked up one, and Dewan picked up the last one, and she goes, oh, they're all gone. And you could see everybody in the line behind us kind of like lower their head, sigh, and wander off.
Looking at you guys like, you bastards. Yeah. You know, but,
and then I came by his booth later that afternoon with Ronnie so we could talk Cardinals baseball.
Good luck. Yeah. I would have not been able to stand around for that. So. It's a good thing I wasn't there.
Well, it wasn't. Yeah, we weren't enthusiastic about our talk this season.
Right. All right. Another question.
Yeah.
Going to this con, like I said, this is the first con I have been to in several years.
And you had to fly there.
Yeah. Did this con give you any motivation or desire to go to more cons more often?
I don't know. I enjoyed it and all that, but one of my things for going to the cons is to find some books that I'm looking for. And this con... And I've been to a couple others and noticed the books were expensive, and I thought, well, maybe this is a bigger one and there'll be more vendors and it won't be. But this just kind of confirmed that, you know, unless I guess you're there at the end of the last day, there's no deals to be had. And that is one of my main reasons for going.
Yes. I think you find, and I know you have because you've bought some things, I think you're more likely to find deals in these smaller little hotel cons that you go to.
Mm-hmm.
That's not all that well promoted. Like, there's another convention, Dallas Fan Expo. Dallas is the biggest convention here, and it was last weekend as well, the same weekend as C2E2. So I didn't get a chance to go to it. But there's another con that'll be here in July. I will probably go to that small con.
You gonna take Sparky with you?
I would love to. I'm really going to work. I'll try to work on that. But it's a small kind. But they've had some big names. Last year they had Jim Shooter there.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I'm hoping in something like that to find deals. I think that's where you're more likely to find than these mega cons that are just.
Yeah, I've been to a few, so you know, to let the listeners know, I'm in St. Louis, and we have a few great individuals in St. Louis that kind of set up little micro cons and things, and you know, about two or three times a year they'll rent out a meeting room in a Holiday Inn or right. a Holiday Inn Express or something, and they'll get some other local shops and some other people and all that have online stores, and they'll come and set up, and they have great stuff there, and lots of variety. Now they don't have any, you know, $500,000 books up on the wall, and I've actually gone there and I've bought slabs and books because they have reasonable prices on it because they're bringing stuff there to sell. So
right.
again, they may have the one or two cherry eye candy items up there that they've got priced such that it's not going to sell, but then there's got stuff they want to move. And that's where I think you're right. You know, that's more where it's almost like what I've seen and I heard on some of the comments after the con is the dealers go there to kind of maybe sell to each other as opposed to the public.
Yeah, they might. They might do that. I know I saw the walking by that Heritage Auctions had a booth there and they were doing some auctions. I didn't.
Were they actually auctioning?
Yeah, they had a little sign, a poster. They said the next auction will be at blah blah blah, you know, 2:30.
Hmm.
And I never did get back to see one, but they were definitely.
Well, I would have noticed that. I'd have wanted to go see that.
I would have. Yeah, I should have because I would like to have seen what they were selling, what they were going for.
I know CGC was there pressing and grading books on site, so you could like turn in books Friday morning and you'd get them back by like Sunday.
Right.
And I debated doing that. It's a little more expensive, but. You don't pay the shipping, and I think it's really affordable for modern books, but all mine were pre-74, and that's when the prices really start to go up. So, and plus, I didn't want to have to, you know, we had weather coming in, and I think I was going to decided to leave early Sunday, and I didn't want to bring books up and then not be able to get them Sunday afternoon unless I stayed, and then I would end up having them shipped anyway. And
right.
So that didn't work out for me, but I wouldn't have minded going by and maybe talking to him about some stuff in the process and, you know, some general trends and just some interesting aspects more from the preservation of comics.
Right. Now that would have been interesting to do. I don't know if CBCS had a booth there. I didn't see one.
I don't think they did. And I actually read something where they're moving to Texas. They're moving from Florida to Texas. I can't tell you where. Well, they got bought by Beckett. And I don't know is Beckett in Texas?
I don't know. Beckett.
But
I couldn't tell you.
But CBCS has got an issue now where they've got like a 6 to 9 month backlog on books. So if you send in anything, it's going to take 6 to 9 months before you get it back.
Well,
where they used to be pretty quick turnaround time.
That's a little, but I'm kind of locked into using them because I'm thinking about on this one book anyway, because I'm really considering having my Tech 880 graded and slabbed.
Mm-hmm. Unless there's a witness, CBCS is the only one that's going to say it's an actual genuine signature.
Right. So I'm kind of locked in with them, which I don't mind. And if it takes 6 months, it's not like I get it out every couple of days and you know, look at it.
And I guess, And then that brings on to the subject of like, how do you think signatures affect the value of books? Some people think that makes them go up. Some people think it does nothing at all. And some of us don't really like signatures on books, even though I did get quite a few this weekend. But generally don't like it.
You know, I don't think there's a simple answer to it. I think a signature on a book in some cases will increase the value.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a signature on a book would it ever decrease the value? It might have no effect at all.
Well, I don't know about the value, but sometimes it decreases the appeal for me. So what if you got an Action Comics #1 with a Schuster signature?
good question.
Well, for one thing, you'd have an action number one.
Yeah. I would take it if somebody gave it to me. Sure.
You know, what about a Tech 27 with a Bob Kane?
Oh, if it's Bob Kane, it's, yeah, I don't want it.
But if it's a Bill Finger?
No, yes. Number one, that would be so, there's no way Bill Finger would ever have been given a chance to sign one. But yeah, if I found, yeah, I would want that. I don't know, I'm just, yeah. Bob Kane did a lot of good stuff, but he's also a complete jackass when it came to...
Well, you know, you did have a good interaction with Terry Moore.
Yeah. Briefly. I just kind of got my... said hi. He's a nice guy, too. He's another one of those that, goes out of his way and is very down to earth. Mm-hmm. And he did that sketch for Ronnie, because Ronnie had been emailing him months ago about... He wanted Terry Moore to do a sketch on Animosity sketch cover.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about the time that the Moores were coming out with the Motor Girl hardcover omnibus. Yeah, they were doing it. They just did
Greatest thing to come out in 2017.
My favorite, without question. So they kind of got lost, and they didn't really... Because what was going to happen... Originally, Ronnie was going to mail his Animosity book to Moore. He was going to do the sketch and then bring it and have it at C2E2.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of fell through. I think I'm sure the Moores got busy with the Motor Girl omnibus. But then they made a deal where Ronnie took that to him on Friday morning and got it back the next day. He didn't do the sketch at the table, but he took it and got Ronnie's sketch, which is really nice.
Yeah, I know. And then Ronnie's showing it to me. I'm like, you don't have this in a bag and board? Well, no, but I'm trying to be careful not to scuff it. It's like, here, have a bag and board. Because
yeah.
You know what? When you go to a con, you bring bags and boards.
Yep. Yeah, that's, yeah. You don't want to walk around with them.
Even though it was our first con, we knew enough about that.
Yeah, well, that's pretty intuitive. It's like, do you want to protect something with that crowd? You know, and I was being careful because after I got Jock's signature, I didn't put it right back in the bag because I'm like, want to make sure that this was dry, that I didn't smear it. And we were walking along, and we're starting to get towards the crowd, and you were like, get that thing in the bag.
Yeah, I know. Well, that was what Ronnie was getting a bunch of stuff from Aftershock. They had a lot of people there that were coming through, and he bought one of the Shock hardcover, and he was going and having different people sign it, and they would sign it, and he'd have to sit there and hold it for like a minute or two to let the ink dry. So, you know, there's an invention waiting. There's an opportunity there for somebody to do like a signature pen that dries instantly so you don't smear the signatures.
Well, and maybe this was. I don't know. I didn't even look at it, but I just was erring on the side of caution.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to smear it. You got a Tech 880, which is rare, which is kind of hard to get and expensive. And then you got Jock's signature. Yeah, you don't want to smear it.
And, you know, we were debating about where to have it signed.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't say, I just let him sign it where he wanted to. And he signed it right there. There's an open space, the Joker's chin. And I have since, I've been out looking at eBay at Tech 880s.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone that I saw that he signed it in that same place.
Oh, okay.
So it's like his default.
It's like a white space, so that's where the pen, that's where you're going to have the... That's where you're going to see the signature. I can understand that. But yeah, it's like we saw people in line that would have it in bags and boards, but they had cut out where they wanted the signature and surrounded it by painter's tape so they could sign in that specific spot.
That's clever. That's a clever idea.
You've never seen that before?
No, I had not seen that.
Okay. Yeah, Nick hadn't either, and so I was like, wow.
But that is clever. I might consider doing that in the future. If I get a book signed, like you, I am not that big on signatures. If it's a trade or hardcover and there's a fly leaf on the inside, yeah, I don't mind getting it. But having covers of comic books signed is not something I...
Well, I know back in the day they would sign the down at the bottom in the white space on the first page. Because right. I've ended up buying books and ended up finding, well, there's a Frank Miller signature. And I picked up an issue of Daredevil when I was around there. And he opened it up, and down there it says Frank Miller. I'm like, huh, didn't know that. Neither did the guy that sold it to me.
Yep.
But I do think it's a more recent phenomenon in the past 10, 15 years of signing on the cover.
Right.
Where it used to be they signed on the interior. But, you know, that may have come back with the advent of slabbing books, because if you have a signature and you slab the book, you could never see the signature.
Well, yeah, that's true.
You just got to take somebody's word for it.
Yeah, well, that's probably, I'm almost certain that's a factor in it. Like I said, you know, I'm much more likely to get signatures on a hardcover or a trade.
Mm-hmm.
And on the inside. But I'm not
then
that,
on the cover of a floppy?
Yeah, but I'm not that. Signatures are nice, but they don't.
For me, they don't increase the value of a book. I don't know if they'll decrease the value, but I don't know about increasing the value.
You know, I don't know either. And I don't know what the signature would do on my Tech 880. It increases the personal value for me, because I would either have this slabbed or put it in a case or something and display it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, I, you know, I just really love Jock's work, and that was such a. And I've got a couple others that if I ever see him again at a con, I might get signed. The first issue of Black Mirror, which is Detective Comics 770, is another one. I saw a couple people in line for him that were getting that mm-hmm. signed. If he's ever at another con that I go to,
Have that print of that cover up
yeah,
there also?
Yeah, he had a print of that. That was the one he had the print of and was selling. I didn't even look to see what the price was.
It's probably, you know, most stuff there at the con you were finding out was like $15 to $25.
Right.
Unless it was Neil Adams.
Yes. Well, you bought a couple, and I bought three of those.
The foil Batman
covers.
Batman covers. From, yeah, the new, the rebirth. Like, I think you got issues 41, 42, and 44. And then I got 44. I got that issue of Deathstroke with Batman.
Yeah. I got the two that had Poison Ivy on it. And then
yeah, those did look nice.
The 44 with Cat Selena in her wedding gown.
Mm-hmm.
Or supposed wedding gown. Yeah, I got. I was like 41, 42, and 44. And I was showing my wife, like, oh, yeah, I bought these at the convention. Her first question was, well, where's 43?
Like, you know, and I was looking for it, too, on the stand. I'm like, well, they got 41 and 42 and 44. And I'm like, where's 43?
They didn't have one that I saw.
They might have sold out, because I think I was reading where they were only selling 100 a day of each cover.
Yeah.
But I don't know what was special about 43 why it would sell out. I would think the 44 would sell out before the 43.
Well, they didn't. I noticed that they only had the 44, because there was two covers, two variants on that.
Yeah, but they only had the Catwoman cover.
They only had the Catwoman. So I don't know if they had a Batman sold out, the silver.
I was looking for it too.
So they didn't have that on display. So they probably sold out of that.
I don't know. We were there pretty early. I would have think we would.
I don't know. But anyway, it was just funny, because I was like, you're missing the point here. It's not to get the numbers.
Well, and I guess that's another aspect that maybe we didn't explore as fully. So that was a con exclusive. So was there anywhere you went where, and you know, like Ronnie got the Aftershock hardcover, which was the cover of that was different. It was a con exclusive. I think I got a couple of Valiant books that were con exclusive, and then we got those foils that were con exclusive. But I mean, there was also those little pop figures, con exclusives, and these people were walking around with these boxes of I don't know what, but I'm supposing those were con exclusives. You know, I wonder if we missed out on some stuff by not chasing those down.
Might have. Yeah, if I go next year, I'm going to go with a much more specific plan. Hey, try to have the list of what I'm wanting, and try to get some information that if they are con exclusives, what are they, and what ones mm-hmm. did I want, and then hit those Friday. That was another thing I would change. I didn't get my flight. Didn't get to Chicago until 12:40, and by the time I got my luggage, which I'm not going to go on a rant about O'Hare Airport. I'm just going to say it's my least favorite airport that I've flown into. Now,
well, then you haven't flown through LaGuardia.
I used to fly into LaGuardia, my previous job that I had, and that was from about 2005 to 2011. And the headquarters for PepsiCo is in Purchase, New York. So we would fly into LaGuardia and then rent a car. I never had an issue at LaGuardia, but from what Aaron was telling me, they're renovating it now, and there's whole sections of the place that's not accessible. But I never had a problem with LaGuardia. But O'Hare, it's always been a pain in the butt. The one flight, you know, my wife and I have traveled quite a bit over the years, haven't so much recently, but of all the flights that my wife and I have taken, the only one we missed was at O'Hare, because the flight was delayed, and we had to try to run all the way down this one terminal, and then all the way to the end of the other. It's like you have to walk, it seems like you have to walk 2 miles in everywhere you want to get in at O'Hare. So anyway, that rant is over, a little mini rant, but yeah, it was 3 o'clock by the time I got to the hotel, or you guys met me, so next year, if I go, definitely, I want to get there earlier Friday. I'll take an early flight.
Like a Dewan flight?
Yeah, a Dewan flight.
7 to 7?
Well, it's going to take longer than that because I'm further away. It's a 2.5 hour flight.
There you go. Yeah. And what I'm going to do differently next year is I'm not going to get there to be when it opens, because on Friday, you don't have to be. Why go stand in line? You wait till 10 minutes after it opens. You just walk through it and you go in because it's not crowded.
Right.
I mean, yeah. We got there at 9:30 and we queued up, and so we had to stand around for a half hour, and then we went in. I mean, you had the people that were in front to run to go get all these exclusive stuff, but we weren't there for the exclusive, so we could have gotten there about 20 minutes, you know, gotten there about 5-10 minutes after it opened and just waltzed on in and just been completely happy and not ever had to wait anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I would do the same. And that's what we did Saturday morning, because we were in a bit of a hurry because I had that interview at 11:10.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't leave the hotel until after 10.
Yeah, it was about 15, 20 minutes after 10.
Right.
Yeah.
And we had no problem other than having to go through that damn security checkpoint, which was an absolute joke. An absolute joke. I mean, they just take your bag and just kind of glance inside of it.
Well, I guess they're catching the obvious stuff.
Right. So it was like, it was nothing like what happens at the airport.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you want to wrap this up tonight?
Yeah. That's about all I had.
So. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter occasionally at UTENGR.
You can find me at JForgets.
And I think you can tweet the show at
BOTR Comic.
And then immediately following us here talking, you're going to hear Jay and his interview.
Yes. Mags Visaggio, who's the writer of the new DC Young Animal book, Eternity Girl.
Yes. And so, we're going to lead you into the interview. Good night.
Good day.
I have the pleasure now of speaking with Mags Visaggio, writer of Eternity Girl, the new book as part of DC's Young Animal line. And I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
This character, Caroline Sharp, is a new original creation in the Young Animal line, but I know it comes out of a piece that you wrote for Eternity Girl as part of one of the Shady Girls.
It's Element Girl.
Living Girl. Element Girl, excuse me.
No, it's okay. It's easy to mix them up.
Yes. Talk a little bit about your process of developing this character from that beginning.
So the book was originally going to be an Element Girl book.
Right.
And for a variety of reasons, it was sort of decided that it would be a better direction to make an original character in terms of there's you get an extra level of freedom to take the character in other directions when you're not tied down by all the continuity, and especially considering as we started thinking about a bunch of the sort of bigger themes in the book. So as much as we talk about depression as a theme of Eternity Girl, it's also a book that's about what it's like to be rebooted again and again and again, which is something that Element Girl kind of wasn't. She didn't get rebooted repeatedly. She's had just one or two incarnations over the decades. And I wanted to do a character who had this, richer backstory than Element Girl, who was always a very minor character, ever really had. And so by going with an original character, what we were able to do was to invent this whole fictitious publication history, which we included in the Milkhorse titles. And that's something that's going to be carried forward as the book goes on. Themes about reincarnation, themes about... basically, you know how like that plays into like hopelessness and feeling trapped. Basically, going with an original character, although the stamp of Element Girl is still all over it, and that's very deliberate because the psychology of Element Girl was the key to it. But by going with the original character, what we were able to do was, I think, take the themes that we already wanted to do and really elevate them in ways that we wouldn't have been able to had we used the existing character.
I know one of the more, one of the most intriguing things that struck me about the character, almost in an ironic sense, is that she's described as a former human in the biopic. But the things that she is struggling with, like the depression, sense of purpose, identity, are some of the most fundamental human, you know, aspects that we deal with. And I know that's part of what you're trying to do with this work. Can you talk a little bit more about what you're intending to do with this particular series?
In what sense?
I guess what are you trying to bring to the reader?
I'm just trying to bring to the reader what feels to me like a pretty frank depiction of what depression feels like, through a fantastical sci-fi superhero lens. So the book, like I said, kind of goes all over the place, and like we end up dealing with a lot of themes of like reincarnation. But that's just another way of underlining the sense of hopelessness that she deals with. That like, so a thing that's going to be coming up is this idea that, you know, the endless cycles of reboots, the endless cycles of universal resets, just mean that no matter what happens, she can, even when she die, if she could die, she could never die because she would just come back in the next reset, and that there's just sort of this endless cycle that she can't get out of. And that's not about, that's not a statement about the universe or religion or anything like that. It's just a statement of sort of, it's taking her sense of feeling helpless and hopeless and turning it into something that's like objectively true. There's no way out. And I wanted to underline that sense of feeling trapped. But just through this like fantastical, you know, sort of lens.
Right. On this book, you're collaborating with Sunny Liu on art and Chris Chepri on colors. How did this creative team come together?
We actually struggled a lot when trying to cast the book. So I brought the pitch to Young Animal, and I originally was thinking, because of the Element Girl short, that I was like, I wanted to work with Selena Ganesha on it, who we ended up giving a cover to. But Gerard didn't think she had the right vibe for the story I was presenting, and so we started like talking about other artists. And we were all over the place. We were looking at Chris Anka, we were looking at Mike Diodato, we were looking at Brett Parsons, all over, so many different artists. And at some point, I just remembered how much I loved the work Sunny Liu did in Dr. Fate, which was this, it's a superhero title, it doesn't feel like a superhero title, and that's what this is. I thought it would bring the right vibe, and so I threw out Sunny's name, and Gerard and Jamie Rich, who was the editor on the book during the development process, were like, oh, yeah, that's perfect. And so we reached out to him, excuse me, and he was game. And I think he's really brought something inimitable to it. He elevates my work in a way that I've sort of never had it done. He is very willing to get away from what I've requested on the page to find a better visual solution to what the page needs to accomplish. And he's been developing this visual iconography for it that really starts really popping up the next issue that I think is very unique. It's a book that's not really going to look like anything else on the shelves, especially as it moves forward.
Now, Sunny Liu, if my information is correct, he lives in Singapore.
Yeah, he lives in Singapore.
What, if any, challenges does that present in working together?
It just can kind of be a little inconvenient. That's kind of it. Everything really goes through Andy Corey, and he's closer. So Andy is our editor on the book at DC, and he's closer in time zone to Andy than he is to me because Andy's on the West Coast.
Right.
So he really just Andy just coordinates everything. Sunny will sometimes message me at what is for me really early in the morning. Like I'll wake up to messages that I have to like deal with while I'm getting ready in the morning. But usually it's not really an issue. Generally, it's just like he has a question and he figures that'll be easier than going through DC to get it. But it isn't always, because our schedules simply don't really align because of the 12-hour difference.
Sure. And as of now, this is intended to be a 6-issue series.
Yes.
Correct? Okay. Well, I think it's a very unique addition to the Young Animal lineup.
Thank you so much.
Really pleased. I'm looking forward to seeing where it plays out. And I want to thank you again for taking the time.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks.